Mark 7 is our text today as we get underway with our survey through the New Testament. Mark 7, this is the outline that we're following. And this is from L.A. Stopher. We are in the Galilean ministry, and next week we will finish the Galilean ministry. As we expand upon that, we are in the last of the sections dealing with this Galilean ministry, where, as Stopher outlines that, it focuses on the confession. In his outline, he's driving toward chapter 8, the conclusion. Now, one of the things that we're seeing in the Gospel of Mark, and I don't know if you this is true with you, I've seen this every time we've studied the Gospel of Mark, but I'm more impressed this time than I ever been before, the speed with which Mark gets to his point. He's a fast-paced writer, and he, with speed, gets to the point that it took Matthew a little longer. Now, each are writing by inspiration, so God had a purpose in mind. But be that as it may, chapter 15 is where it took Matthew to get to this point. And in Matthew 15, as we outline the book of Matthew, this was in the section of what the people thought about the teaching of Jesus. And so Mark is making a similar point here. And so part of what Mark 7 is about is, here's the reaction that he had to his teaching. So let's get ahead of ourselves to look at some things in Mark 7 before we get to our reviews. Mark 7 is going to focus on how the Pharisees reacted and to Jesus, looking for fault in Jesus. That's one of the reactions. Let's get ahead of ourselves to the end of chapter 7. And at the end of chapter 7, the people were astonished. So there were multitudes of people who were amazed and following large crowds. And at the same time, there were those who were following after him, trying to find fault with him. And there's the criticism and the conflicts. I think that's part of what Mark is trying to paint for us in chapter 7. Let's review where we've been so far. Chapter 1 of the book of Mark. That was where we began the Galilean ministry. And so we got underway quite quickly as we've been emphasizing Mark's speed with which he gets. Chapter 2, conflict with the Pharisees. That started early. We see that again here. So we saw there is a connection between the concepts of chapter 2 and chapter 7. Chapter 3, controversy over the Sabbath. Very good. Over the Sabbath healing. So that began early in the Galilean ministry, and it continued throughout the Galilean ministry. Chapter 4, parables. Chapter 5, miracles, three miracles. And then last week, chapter 6, John beheaded and more miracles. We're going to see two miracles in our study this morning. All right, let's talk about Mark 7. Two things happen here. The Pharisees rebuked the disciples for eating with unwashed hands. We're going to see the question, and then we're going to see the answer that is given to that, how Jesus responds, and he responds in three points, and we'll put those on the screen here in just a moment. And then there are miracles of Jesus. There's the healing of this Gentile woman's daughter, the Syrophoenician woman, and then there is the deaf mute that was healed, who seems to be singled out from the crowd that was mentioned in Matthew's account, if you've looked at your parallel account. That Matthew doesn't mention this deaf mute by name. He's not mentioned by name here, but he's specified here. But in Mark's account, it's just in the midst of a bunch of miracles. And we'll say some more about the significance of all that here in just a moment. Now, if we're looking at parallel accounts, which I try to each time, not only in class, but in preparation, I try to look at the parallel accounts because there may be some information that will enhance my understanding by looking at that parallel account, something that prompted an answer, a question that may be asked, and we'll get to some of that in a moment. But Luke and John don't tell us anything about these accounts, only Matthew and Mark. So basically, you'll see this again, but basically Matthew 15 is going to be your parallel account. So if you're needing to flip over, go back to Matthew 15, we'll do that as we go further. All right, let's get underway with verses. I'll come back to my questions rather. Let's talk about the question now in verses 1 to 5. the Pharisees and some of the scribes. And a scribe was one who copied the law, as you well know, and had familiarity with the law and could quote the law. That didn't mean they understood the law, nor did it mean they practiced the law. This means they could quote the law. They, because of copying it word for word, they had understanding of that. They also were teachers. We'll say more about the elders, who they would be in just a moment, but here we have the scribes and Pharisees come from Jerusalem, and this would connect, without us taking the time to go back to do that, in Mark 2. The same group of people have found fault with Jesus previously, and they're coming for that purpose now. When they saw that the disciples ate bread with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands, they found fault. Now remember, Mark is writing for a Gentile audience. So Mark is seemingly commenting for the Gentile audience what it means with defiled hands. A Jew would have not understood that. This is not a matter of hygiene. We'll say more about that in a moment. This is not that, as we think of, you saw somebody eat lunch and they didn't go to the restroom and wash their hands or cleanse their hands and they may get germs. This was a ceremonial washing the uncleanness, the ceremonial uncleanness. And more symbolic than anything, and we'll get to that at verse 3 here in just a second. And so they found fault with the disciples because they did not go through the ritual of washing hands. Now Mark gives us some details that Matthew doesn't tell us, in Matthew 15, by the way. So look at verse 3. This is Mark's, by inspiration, comment. I don't mean this is just his idea, but Mark, by inspiration, is now commenting for the Gentile audience. This is what this is all about. So he says at verse 3, the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, and I'm reading from the New King James, in a special way. Your translation may render that differently. We'll talk about that. Holding to the tradition of the elders. And we'll talk about the tradition in a moment. Let's talk about the special way. That again was a ritual and not a matter of hygiene. Not a matter we want to wash the germs off of our hands because we don't want to be contaminated with bacteria. And so we want to make sure that when we're touching the food, we're not getting some germs. That's not the point. So push that aside. The reason you wash your hands before you eat is different than theirs. So it's a ritual. So what does it mean here in a special way? Well, the word that's translated thus can mean often or frequently. And the King James, and it's a difficult word, by the way. Several scholars, not only commentators, but Greek scholars, have gone back and forth on exactly what does that word mean. So the translators of the King James thought it meant more often, that they do this often and frequently. Well, they did. And so perhaps that's what it means. The American Standard renders that, and remember it's a little more of a wooden translation, that they did it diligently or vigorously. Well, they would do that. So that's true as well. So they were very diligent, meaning it may have to do with vigorous cleansing, but it may have to do more with that they continually did it, not only often, but they were very diligent. You don't want to miss an occasion where you need to do that. Now let's get ahead of ourselves to go to verse 4. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. That is, they've come from an unclean place. They're ceremonially unclean. So since they've come from an unclean place, there may have been some Gentiles there. That would be terrible to come in contact with a Gentile. And so since you've come in contact with some things at the marketplace that may be unclean, you need to go through this cleansing. Now that wasn't mentioned in the scriptures, but it was mentioned in the concepts of the tradition. Now let's go back to this concept of in a special way. The Holman's Christian renders that, they did it ritually. But I'm going to give you one I think makes more sense. Thayer suggests in the New King James footnote, notice in your footnote in your New King James, with the fist. Now, A.T. Robertson is one of the ripest Greek scholars in the last 100 years, by many account, so you may disagree with that. But A.T. Robertson was not a commentator, but he was a lexicographer. And probably did as much work on Greek and New Testament Greek as anyone. But anyway, Robertson, and I lean heavily on him, he thinks it means with a clenched hand. And that agrees then with the fist, and Thayer says it means with the fist. So the idea seems to be that they would cleanse their hands and you would rub it ceremonially up to the elbow with a clenched fist, symbolizing I am washing and cleansing off, sometimes even without water, that I'm cleansing taking the uncleanness off of me. And the disciples ate without going through this ritual with a fist. Does that make sense? It's a ceremonial cleansing. Now, they not only would clean their hands, but let's go to verse 4 now. That when they come from the marketplaces, there are many other things which they have received, that is from the tradition of the elders, like the washing of cups and the pitchers and copper vessels and couches. That's literally beds. You think, how do they wash their couch? If you're thinking of your couch, your sofa, that's not what they're talking about. It's talking about a bedroll that would be rolled up. Now, it's a textual issue between the minority and the majority text and minority text. Your translation may not have beds or couches, and that's a textual issue. So it may not be supposed to be there. I don't know. I'm going to leave it at that. But it has to do with the textual variation between the two major Greek texts. But if it is there, it just simply talks about a bedroll. That they would, if they had carried their bedroll with them, and it had come in contact with something unclean or someone unclean, then they need to go through the ritual of symbolizing a cleansing. Wash the uncleanness off. Is that making sense? All right. Now, verse 5, the Pharisees and the scribes ask, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders? I've lost my place. Yeah, verse 5. Not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with unwashed hands. Now, who were the elders? The elders were the obviously older, that simply means those who are older, but it would have to do with either scribes or particularly the rabbis, that older generation that passes it down. Let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 13. You might underline handed down. The tradition is something that was handed down from generation to generation. This was not given by revelation of God, but this was something that they taught that generation to do, and then that generation taught the next generation, and that generation taught the next generation. This was a tradition handed down by commandments of men. So there are three phrases I want you to tie together. One is tradition, mentioned twice or three times here, verse 5, and in verse 6, or verse 5 rather, and then at verse 7, the commandments of men, that's the tradition. And the third phrase is handed down at verse 13. Making sense? A commandment of men handed down was their tradition. All right, making sense? So that's the question. Now, how did Jesus answer that? Question number whatever. Two.
One thing is quoted from Isaiah, something.
All right. He quoted Scripture. What was the point he made from that Scripture? Quoted in Isaiah 6. Go ahead.
They try to honor men, but they don't do it by God's way.
All right. Quotes from Isaiah 29 and 13. Now, it's interesting to look at Isaiah 29, the various translations of Isaiah 29:13, as it relates back to this, which is another study within itself. You may want to pursue that. He said, well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites? His first point is, you're guilty of hypocrisy. You're guilty of hypocrisy. In other words, you're not the people you pretend to be. In other words, the Pharisees and the scribes acted like we try to follow the law. We want to do exactly what is right. We want to do what's honorable and right. And why do your disciples not do that? He said, you're nothing but hypocrites. You're not what you pretend to be. You go through a ritual, but your heart's not there. This is a matter that they have learned by tradition or by rote. The New American Standard so translates Isaiah 29 and 13. Anyway, these people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Here's another part of the hypocrisy. In vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. In other words, you claim to be serving the God Almighty, but you're interested in advocating the commandments of men, your traditions. Now, how do they do that? Verse 8. Say again. Absolutely. They're binding where God has not bound, and they were loosing where God had not loosed. In other words, they were giving emphasis to commandments of men and ignoring the commandments of God. They're not interested in following God at all. But they claim to be, so thus they're hypocrites. Now let's start at verse 8 through verse 13. They were really rejecting the commandments of men. Notice you lay aside the commandment of God and you hold tradition of men. The washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things you do. Many other such things. You might underline that. We're going to see that again in a moment. We'll make a point about that. Many other such things you do. Think about what you learned from that. We'll talk about what we learned. Now, verse 9. All too well you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition. I like the way the New International renders that. You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God. In other words, you take your traditions and then you're able to shove aside what you don't like about what God's told you to do. You're hypocrites. You're not what you claim to be, and you reject the commandments of God. Now, he gives an illustration. What's his illustration? He illustrates the point, how they reject the commandments of God by their tradition. Moses said, honor your father and mother. And the one who curses his father and mother, let him be put to death. That's a combination of two references in the book of Exodus. So let's get those. Exodus 20, in the giving of the Ten Commandments, verse 12, honor your father and mother. Repeated in Deuteronomy 5. He combines that with Exodus 21 and 17, the one who curses father and mother should be put to death. He said, that's what the law said. Honor father and mother, and it was so severe that you're to be put to death if you don't. All right, he combined two verses to make his point. But you say what? All right. By the way, Corbin is a transliteration. What's a transliteration? Not a translation, transliteration. Taking the sounds of the original word by sound, carrying it over. Baptism, baptizo, the original word baptizo, baptism is a transliteration. All right, this is a transliteration. In other words, the original word basically sounds like Corbin. What does it mean? It means dedicated to the temple. So he said, here's how you take that command, honor your father and mother. Take care of your father. It's not just respect, but honoring father and mother means you take care of your parents. You provide for them as they have need, taking care of your mother if she's a widow, etc. And so when the time comes, you take care of your mother, you say, oh, it's Corbin. In other words, what money I had to take care of my parents, I gave it to the temple. And so consequently, would they put him to death? No, because verse 12 said, you no longer let him do anything for his father and mother. You say, okay, you're not obligated. What you just did is set aside the commandments of God, and you're doing it by your traditions. Making the word of God of no effect through your traditions, which you have handed down. Here we go again. What do you see at the end of verse 13? All right, by their traditions, there's a phrase at the end of verse 13. Many other such things you do. What do you learn from that? To my knowledge, I don't think Matthew mentioned that. I think Mark's the only one who mentions, and many other such things you do. Maybe I missed it, Matthew. I learned something from that.
One thing, you could open the door.
Say that louder. Bingo, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Yes, departure goes on and on. When you open that door, you can't get it closed. When you set aside one command of God, you're going to set aside all of your commands of God. Make sense? Or you may want to follow this one, but you open the door for somebody else to take that one away. And so when you disrespect one law of God, you're going to disrespect all laws of God and many other such things you do. In other words, they pretty much did what they wanted. Any command they wanted to set aside, they would set it aside. So if you're taking this command and saying, I don't have to follow that, the only reason you're following another command is because it's not a problem. But when it becomes a problem, you're going to set it aside too. Make sense? Say again. It's a heart issue, yes. And he's going to get to that. Very good. All right. Now then, let's start at verse 14 through verse 23. Jesus makes the point of what?
What defiles a man?
What defiles a man? So he said at verse 15, there is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him. Is that a true statement? So if I take poison, it's not going to defile me? All right, very good. He is not talking about physical defilement, and we need to clarify that because those who say a Christian can take foreign substance into their body, such as drugs, alcohol, defending, I don't know, you may not be aware that there have been a number of Christians who publicly debated whether or not a Christian could smoke. And so it's okay for the Christian to smoke, we're told, because that which goes into the body doesn't defile the body. So there, and that's been the argument made. There's a number of those in print if you care to search those out and find them. But this is not talking about physical, but spiritual defilement, as Kevin just pointed out from verse 19. He is not saying what goes into the body will not harm the physical body, but what goes into the body doesn't defile one spiritually. What the point is, what comes from the heart is what matters, according to verse 19. That's his point. And so if evil comes from your heart's evil. If good comes from your heart is good. And so change the heart, you change the man. So let's get the rest of that, and we're going to move on. Notice at verse 16, if anyone has ears to hear, let him hear. What do you learn practical from that? If anyone has ears. Pay attention. It's a choice. Good point. Say again. Yeah, means understanding. Say again. Good point. That's what I'm fishing for right there. Yes. All these are good points, but not everybody is ready to hear. Not everybody's ready to hear. Have you ever tried to, forget about spiritual things, have you ever tried to talk to somebody about something, maybe it's somebody in your family, about some subject, and you realize they weren't ready to listen to that? We'll come back later and deal with that. Or maybe you try to teach someone the gospel and they're not interested. Later they may be, but they're not interested now. Not everybody is ready to hear. Not everybody's ready to hear. That friend that you tried to teach may not be ready. Maybe later, but not now. Does that make sense? Not everybody's ready. All right. Verse 17 mentions a parable. This is not actually a parable. The illustration concerning what he's just talked about, explain that to us. What are you talking about here? So this discussion takes place privately away from the crowd. The disciples ask him about this illustration. Now, let's flag something here in Matthew's account. Matthew chapter 15, it's at this point where the disciples seem to sympathize with the Pharisees. You're offending the Pharisees. Remember that? Matthew 15, 12 to 14. And then that's where Jesus begin to respond and makes a couple of points. So you might turn over there just to flag. I know we're getting crunched for time, but Matthew 15 at verse 12, that's where Jesus said, every plant which my Father has not planted shall be rooted up. They're blind leaders of the blind. Let them alone. And then that's where Peter said, well, tell me, explain the parable to us. Now we're ready to pick up with verse 19. So what does Jesus explain here? What is his explanation? Here's what I mean by what I just said.
Starts back in verse 19, whatever things enter his heart, sand washing their hands, that is not what defiles a man. But now the heart comes all these sexual desires and everything like that. That's what defiles a man.
Absolutely. Verse 20. Verse 21. I'll get there in a minute. For from within the heart of man proceeds. In other words, all of the sin comes forth from a heart of man. So what you need to be concerned about is not eating with unwashed hands so that some uncleanness has entered into your body, but you need to be concerned about what comes out of your heart and out of your mind, like evil thoughts, adulteries, fornication, murder, thefts, covetous, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, that's the same as lasciviousness, an evil eye. Some translations don't have that, but it simply has to do with envy. Bedag suggests that word means envy. Blasphemy, pride, and foolishness. So it's just a whole passel of sins, and every one of them comes from the heart. That's what you need to be concerned with. And I think what he's pointing to is the fact that they have indeed an evil heart. Make sense? In Mark 7, Mark is painting a picture of what the people thought about Jesus, and as he's going about, they're thinking, we've got to find some fault with him. The charges, Mark 2 indicates the fault is already there. They're just looking for an occasion to find that fault, they think. Does that make sense? The conclusion is already drawn. We got to kill him. We just hadn't found a cause that we can lay to that. And that's what they're looking for. All right. Now let's go to 24 to 37. I think he's still trying to paint a picture of what the people thought about, the reaction of the people. And so here's the reaction of the Pharisees and the scribes. The miracles of Jesus is not just, oh, by the way, he look at the miracles, but look at this Gentile woman who had greater faith than many of the Jews. That makes sense? So let's see about who this Gentile woman is, starting at verse 24. Parallel account is in Matthew 15, by the way. Now, let's talk about verse 24. He arose, he's in Galilee, around the Sea of Galilee, and where did he go? To the region of Tyre and Sidon. All right, let's get the picture here. Here we are in Galilee, right here in the middle of the circle, and the Sea of Galilee. It's been around the Sea of Galilee where he's been working. This is the region of Phoenicia, and you see the city of Tyre. Just north of Tyre, here is Phoenicia, different color here, but here is Sidon and Tyre. He went to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Now, some translations, Sidon might not be mentioned, but it is mentioned the second time a little bit later, so we assume that that's correct, even though some that's, again, a textual variation, I think. All right. What do we know about this woman? She is, what do we know about her character? She is a Gentile. She is not a Jew. She is Syrophoenician, which means, according to your footnote, a Syrian of Phoenicia. So she's from this region of Phoenicia, and she's come to Jesus. She comes begging him. What's her problem? Her daughter has demons. And she's a demon, and begging Jesus to cast out the demon from her daughter. Now let's tie this to Matthew. Matthew 15, 23, at this point, Mark doesn't tell us this. But Matthew tells us the disciples wanted to send her away, thought she was an annoyance. Remember that? Send her away. You want us to get rid of her. Well, that creates a problem. What I want to paint for you is a picture of a woman whose faith comes shining through strong. And one of the obstacles she has is she's a Gentile to start with, coming in contact with a Jew. Secondly, the disciples wanted to get rid of her. Now, Matthew 15, 23 said, here's another obstacle she had to overcome. Jesus' first reaction was what? He ignored her. That seems strange to me. And I take it that what Jesus is doing is calling forth more faith from her. Let's see how strong that faith is. And so her faith overcame the fact she's a Gentile going to Jew. Her faith had to overcome the fact that she was rejected by the disciples. And thirdly, that Jesus at first ignored her. But he's not through with her. Look at verse 27. Jesus said, "Let the children be filled first," that's the Jews, "for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs," compared her to the dogs. And so that seems strange. It's perhaps a test for her and the disciples, again calling forth faith. And how did she respond? Yeah, even the little dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And Jesus said, "For this saying, because you said that, because you show that kind of faith, go your way, the demon is gone." And she went to her house, the demon was gone. And the daughter lying on the bed. Matthew 15:28, Mark doesn't record this, Jesus commended her for her great faith. "I've not seen such great faith, not even in Israel." Make sense? Had a quotation from Bowles. Bowles said, "Her faith takes her out as an exception to the whole Gentile world and holds her up as an example of faith to the Jewish race." You think about that now. It's not this is a great Jew showing great faith because they've grown up in Judaism. This is a Gentile, a Syrophoenician woman, is held up as a great example, not only for the Gentiles, but for the Jews to see. So I'm learning from this. She had power. Jesus had power over distance and power over the demonic world. Make sense? We've listed several of the powers he had. He has powers over demons. Cast them out. But over distance. He didn't have to be there. All right. Questions or comments on that before we go in to the last section? Let's talk about this deaf mute now that is mentioned here. Now, I want to, for what it's worth, go over to Matthew 15 and put this in context with Matthew 15. There are only three verses that are devoted to this section that is the parallel to this. And when you read it, you may think at first, this isn't parallel at all. But in Matthew, following on the heels of this Syrophoenician woman being healed, her daughter being healed, the text says he skirted the Sea of Galilee and da-da-da-da-da. But then in verse 30, great multitudes came, and those that were lame and blind and mute and maimed and many others, they lay down at Jesus' feet and he healed them. And multitudes marveled because they'd seen the mute speaking and the maimed made whole and walking and the blind seeing. So there was a whole passel of people that were healed. That seems to be the parallel account to what Mark is describing as the deaf mute. So I take it that he's one of those. Does that make sense? He's one of that crowd in Matthew 15. Otherwise, we might just mark that off. That's not parallel. Maybe that may be true. I think that is parallel. Now, again, the parallel account would be in those three verses, Matthew 15 through 29 to 31. Now, where does this take place? He left Tyre and Sidon. So that makes us think he was at Sidon because that is in the text. In your text, if you were missing it in the earlier one, that one is found there. So where does he go now? Decapolis. Yeah, right down here. So he came from Tyre and Sidon back, or skirted, Matthew says he skirted the Sea of Galilee and came to the region of Decapolis. All right. Now, with that in mind, let's get this last section, the deaf mute being healed. He came there, and there was one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech. The word impediment is a different word than the word impediment in the next time that it's mentioned in the New King James. The first one means he was thick of tongue or his speech was unclear. And so he could speak, but he couldn't speak clearly, as often the case with those who may be deaf. Now, Matthew's account says many others were healed at the same time, Matthew's account seemed to indicate, as we've already talked about. But nonetheless, I want to pay attention to Verse 32. He came, Jesus, and what did he want Jesus to do? Lay his hand on him. Now, that's interesting. I want you to lay your hand on me. Well, that's exactly what Jesus does. He takes him aside from the multitude and puts his fingers in his ears, put his hands on him like he asked, and he spat and he touched his tongue. And I think that's trying to symbolize that the power is coming from Jesus. Could have healed him at a distance without touching his ears or touching his tongue, but I think it's indicating the power is coming from me. I'm the one that's going to heal your ears. I'm the one that's going to heal your tongue. And so he, looking up to heaven, what did he say? Be opened. Ephatha, which is Aramaic for be opened. And immediately his ears were opened and the impediment of his tongue. Different word this time. The King James talks about the string of his tongue. Your footnote will say the bond of his tongue. His tongue was as if it was tied with a string and bound up, and Jesus loosed the bond or the string. That's the idea. And so that which was binding his speech, Jesus took loose and released. And the reaction was, verse 37, they were astonished beyond measure. We're focusing on the reaction of the people. Now, we got about a minute to go. Let me make 2 points. Here we have power over the body or power over disease. Now, one other point I want to make, and then we're going to have to be done. Verse 36, he commanded they don't tell anyone, but the more he commanded them, the more widely proclaimed. Don't spread this. We really don't know why. We've talked about this multiple times through Matthew and also thus through Mark. Why did Jesus say, don't go broadcast this? We don't really know. We speculate and conjecture that it may be the crowds would be interfering with him in his work. Secondly, it may be the time for full declaration is not, he's not ready for that. People are not ready to see the full declaration. Let me lay the groundwork. That may be it. But most likely the crowds and the throngs will get in the way, because you go start telling this, then the crowds are coming just for the healing. That may be it. So exactly why, we don't know. But the more he told it, and this may be part of the reason too, told them don't tell it, the more they spread it. And the more his fame begins to spread, and more people begin to hear about the miracles. We're going to stop right there.